TBRI.
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 TOVD.
TBRI.
TBRI. Trust-based relational intervention.
TBRI is an attachment-based
trauma-informed intervention
that is designed to meet the complex needs
of vulnerable children.
TBRI uses empowering principles
to address physical needs,
connecting principles for attachment needs,
and correcting principles to disarm fear-based behaviors.
While TBRI is based on years of attachment, sensory processing, and neuroscience research,
the heartbeat of TBRI is connection.
Hello and welcome to the TBRI podcast. You're listening to Season 1, Episode 4. On this show, we talk all about trust-based relational intervention, or TBRI. We talk about different elements of the model itself, but also how TBRI is applied in various systems of care and practice. Today, we're talking with Dr. David Cross, who is the founder and director of our institute. Dr. Cross is also the co-creator of TBRI, so it was extra special to have him here on the podcast. This episode is a great overview of the TBRI empowering principles, and Dr. C gives a little history of the empowering principles and their place within TBRI, and he also touches on everything from self-regulation to meeting sensory needs to transitions and some of the newer developments of the TBRI empowering principles. We're so honored that Dr. Cross shared his wisdom with us today. So without any further delay, here are Sarah and Dr. C.
Well, Dr. C, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for being here.
It's good to be here, Sarah. Always good to be with you. Even awesome. If it's like this Zoomy thing.
Yes. Yep. This is how we meet these days. So today on the podcast, we're going to talk through our empowering principles. And I would say of all of the principles, they have had maybe the biggest makeover, a fresh coat of paint, per se, in the last couple of years. So I think it'll be fun to have you walk us through what the empowering principles look like and how we're really doing a little bit of a deeper dive all the way around. So one of the more recent things is that we've always called the strategies within the empowering principles, the physiological and the ecological strategies, which you have begun to identify as the wisdom of body and the wisdom of places. And that initially for me was like, wait, what? And then it really became solidified when I thought about like, it's actually wisdom around the empowering principles and these strategies is really what it is. Because once I can exercise, being thoughtful and mindful and becoming really wise into what these kids need, then things go so much more smoothly. So when we think about the wisdom of the body or the physiological strategies, we think about things like hydration and nutrition and blood sugar and sleep. Can you give us just a brief look into each of those, why they're important, and maybe how you've seen people out in the field meet those needs?
So first of all, let me say this a little bit about the history of the three sets of principles. So, you know, TBRI initially was simply what Karen did when she was there with those kids in the Hope Connection camp. And It took us time to put words around that. And that, you know, the words are what we now think of as TBRI, but we should never lose sight of the fact that it's the behaviors, it's a practice which, you know, you engage in when you're with kids. So when we were codifying, if you will, what it was that Karen did, we came up with connecting and correcting first. And so, you know, and it was kind of cool because it was, you know, it's, you know, it rhymes or whatever. And so connecting and correcting, and, you know, we were saying things like, you got to connect before you correct and so on. And then my memory of it anyway is that we came up with empowering to kind of cover everything else that wasn't covered in connecting and correcting. So it was kind of a catch-all, which is kind of, you know, makes sense when you look at it. And initially, we really emphasized at least in our codification of it, the physiological strategies, what we now call the physiological strategies. And so things like hydration, you know, making sure that we manage blood sugar levels, that we manage physical activity, that we manage sensory processing, and so on. Those were things that, you know, were built into Karen's practice when she was organizing and leading and doing the Hope Connection camps. And then also when she was taking it into homes and home programs. And so that was, you know, that kind of made a lot of sense. Now, this phrase that I've since come up with, the wisdom of the body, comes from a book that there's actually a book that was written way back in the early 1900s by a guy named Cannon. He's a physiologist. And he was the first one to really say that the body has this magical, almost magical wisdom that's built in. And, you know, you think about it, what our bodies do is they manage our temperatures within a very narrow range. They manage blood sugar. They manage our digestion, all these processes, breathing and so on. The body does without us having to literally even think about it. Okay. And so he's the first one to say that this body has its built, that our bodies have this built-in wisdom. And to me, that was kind of a wonderful insight, because then what it is we're trying to do is help the body do its work. You know, so we're trying to support the wisdom of the body through the physiological strategies. And so we're making sure the body has enough water so it can keep all of the cells of, you know, its cells hydrated. It makes sure that it has, you know, the adequate levels of blood sugar so it can keep all these little engines running, you know, at optimal speed and so on. So that was kind of the origin of the wisdom of the body.
Wow, that is really cool. So to our listeners, we're learning here together today. That's really fun. I don't think I've heard you say that before.
Then I think with the wisdom of places, I think that's, for me, I think it's been a bit more of a journey. And I don't think when Karen was still with us, let me put it this way. I think our major focus was on those physiological strategies, those bodily strategies. In terms of stepping back and thinking about the practice of TBRI, but since then, I've had more opportunity to reflect on it. And what I've realized is that Karen was a master of orchestrating the environment, of orchestrating the ecology. I mean, you know, one good example is the idea of a sensory diet. And, you know, and the calendar was set up in such a way, the daily calendar was set up in such a way that, you know, that it allowed for regular, you know, activity breaks and sensory breaks and snacks and nap times. And when we were at camp, we did the more challenging activities in the morning when people were fresh, but then we did more physical and kids were dealing with some tough stuff in the mornings, you know, so we would do more physical activity, more outside activities in the afternoon. So there was a lot of kind of hidden orchestration of the daily activities and creating an environment that, you know, would support connecting and correcting. So I think it took a while longer to figure out what the words were around that. And that's, you know, and where that ultimately led me to this notion of the wisdom of places. And that comes from a book that's written about, that I read about the, you know, one of the Apache tribes in Eastern Arizona. And literally in their culture, a lot of the wisdom is captured in stories that are connected to places. But as I started thinking about it, like, for example, now one of the things we know is that we become attached to places. And, you know, and one of the things, you know, like, say, if you think about kids, you know, adopted kids or foster kids, we talk a lot about how they get disconnected from their families of origin, but we don't talk about how they get disconnected from places. And places can be really important to us. I know for myself, I grew up spending a lot of time in the wilderness, and that's my go-to place. You know, that's, you know, if I want to go home in, you know, in a psychological sense, I go out into the wilderness. I go out into nature, and think about the things we do. We want to visit our ancestral homes. We want, if a child's adopted from Korea, they not only want to connect with their family, but they want to connect with the place. And so place is important. And then when you start in psychology, place has, is not terribly well understood. And so in some sense, we're trying to figure it out on our own.
I love all of that, Dr. Cross. And I swear every single time I talk to you, I learn something new or I hear something in a different way. And so it's always fun to get to hear you unpack information. And I love that you talk about the unfolding of the empowering principles and how it is a catch-all. And I think it's really helpful to hear. So if we can dig a little bit in, you talked about hydration and blood sugar and nutrition and sleep. And I think as a general rule, we kind of understand those things, right? Like our brains and our bodies function better when we're hydrated and we have sleep and good nutrition and stable blood sugar. But do you have any ways that you've seen any of those things? You could just pick one or two implemented really well. Because sometimes I think that's the harder part, is not to understand the need, but like just to get to the implementation. And I think of do you have any stories to share or instances where you saw those things implemented really well?
Can I say one more thing about the ecological strategies before we
absolutely.
So, there's one ecological strategy that I think we really hit over the head, and that's transitions. And that's a recognition that how we manage the daily ecology is a really important thing. So now to answer your other question,
we will do some more on the ecological strategies.
All right. Too. So like, say, for example, one of the things we talk about in the training is what we call Becky's story. And it was, it was her implementation of TBRI in a school that she was assigned to. And one part of that implementation was water bottles for the kids. Now, one of the things that I think was important about that was each teacher could kind of do that how they wanted. So they managed it according to their knowledge of their kids and their own, teaching practice. But the goal was to get, water easily accessible to kids in every, for every kid in every classroom. An interesting thing about hydration is that I remember one of the trainings, there was a fellow there from, I think from India. And he asked, and he was saying that, what about in places where water's not readily available? And like, in the US, we have running water in all of our schools, pretty much in all of our homes and so on, but there are parts of the world where the children may not have access to, and families and other institutions may not have access to running water. And so the strategies might look different. In fact, the need might be different. Kids, people might have learned, like say for us, we say, I'll keep a glass of water or a bottle of water with me all day long. That may not be an option in some parts of the world. And so the reason I say that is how you do this, the principle stands, but the practice needs to reflect, you might say local conditions or, where you are.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And we're actually going to dive into some different implementation strategies across different cultures further down the line in the podcast. So I think that's such a great point that, the strategy stands, but implementation might vary. When we talk about the sensory motor needs within the physiological strategies or the wisdom of the body, you've added in more specifically, we talk about play and playfulness and playful interaction and playful engagement, right? We have that all throughout TBRI, but most specifically, we now have included the concept of play. And can you spend just a minute and talk a little bit about the importance of play and what does that look like within the context of TBRI?
Okay, that's a great question. So we, you know, if you look at the engagement strategies, we have playful interaction. If you look at the levels of response, we have, you know, playful engagement. And what that particular lens is for, how do we engage with a child or other adults? And to the extent that we can do it playfully, we can disarm fear, we can create a positive learning environment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, what we also did at camp, if you go back and look at, you know, the sort of, you know, the birthplace of TBRI, there was lots of opportunities for just play. Now, the kids we had at camp, they were challenged in a number of different ways, so that free play was a could be a fragile thing. You know, like going out to shoot baskets, you couldn't just have a group of our boys go out and start shooting baskets, because they probably couldn't regulate, you know, self-regulate through that with just them. But we could have a, like one of the buddies go out and shoot baskets with his camper, and the two of them could play in, you know, in a, you know, the way we normally think of, you know, in a, not just be playful, but actually play a game, you know, maybe horse or something like that. And so, I mean, there's a ton of research on the importance of play. It's the, you know, you could, a lot of people say it's a central activity of children as they're developing, particularly younger children. And I put it in the notebook because I didn't want us to lose sight of the fact that play itself is important, which is, you know, it's different. You know, it's like playing house, or it's like shooting baskets, or it's, you know, like playing, you know, tag in the pool or something like that. Right. Those are important crucibles for children's development. And we need to build those in as much as we can.
Right. I think it's a lost art on adults. A lot of times, if you ask a room full of adults, if they are good at playing, or if they understand how to play, about 85% will not be able to say yes to that. It's really fascinating, but especially like context that we work, there's so many boxes we have to check that it seems like that should be the last thing, right? Because it doesn't, nobody's asking you to report about play, right? They're asking you to report about reading markers, or about, you know, did you follow the schedule of the day and all that stuff. And it's like, gosh, we've lost the importance of it. So I was really, really happy to see even more focus on play. And then lastly in this section, and then we'll move on to the ecological strategies and the wisdom of places. But can you talk a little bit about under the, you know, the sensory motor needs, we talk about the scaffolding of physical and emotional regulation. Can you talk a little bit more about that and what that means, and how do we apply that to working with the kids?
Yeah. So saying that this is a pet peeve is a little too strong, but I have some pretty strong feelings around this thing. So the way we have, and this goes back to when, you know, we were, you know, just getting started, we very often in the training and in the coaching of TBRI, if we equate helping children learn to self-regulate with, say, something like engine plates. Okay. Now, engine plates is in the, you know, that whole, you know, that, you know, that, you know, in the context of a nurture group is a great activity for promoting self-regulation and helping kids become more aware of their, you know, regulatory processes and so on. But I don't want people to lose sight of the fact that the primary regulator for children is us. And if you think about, you know, if you go back to, you know, to what we know about parent-infant interaction, and how T. Barry Brazelton, he talks about how the infant's first challenge is to learn to regulate their physiological processes, how important we are as parents in their being able to do that. And then we have a role in helping them learn to regulate their emotional and their, you know, their behavioral processes. And it's our interactions with them, it's our connecting with them, it's our engaging with them that is the primary vehicle for all that to happen. The things we do as activities, I think as structured activities, are scaffolds for all of that. But the bottom line, it's our interactions with the young child. And I think, you know, one of the things, I think that's a lesson from the still face video that we very often show in our trainings with Edtronic's still face procedure. And, you know, and so we can see what the impact of a broke, you know, like a broken connection is on the child's ability to self-regulate. And that should clue us to the importance of the relationship. And as a regulatory mechanism, I guess, for children and adults.
Right. And I appreciate that you said adults, because sometimes in my world, I still need a co-regulator.
Yeah.
I still need, right? Do. Like we all do. It's all about relationships. So if I can see how that's developed over time, the need for regulation is developed within relationship. And if we missed it, then that's the primary goals, right? Is the primary objective is to get into that relationship for co-regulation. And then, like you said, the engine plate comes in as sort of an artifact around that and a way to communicate and talk about it. But it's definitely not our regulator. It's the adult or the safe person, you know, beside us that's our regulator. Yeah. So
an analogy that I don't think is too far off is like, if I get a cut, I'll put a Band-Aid on there to help it heal. And the engine plate is, you know, the healing is interpersonal, but the engine plate activity can be something like a Band-Aid that can support that.
Right, for sure. It's a good reminder for sure to connect people back to the idea of regulation. So within the ecological strategies or the wisdom of places, you've broken those down into the contexts and the joints and the flows of experience. And we talk within the context, we talk about settings and climate and artifacts. Do you want to just give a brief overview of each of those and what that looks like and how we need to pay attention to those things?
Yeah. Let me say for starters is that I recognize that the way I have put that into words is the word I want. It's a little highfalutin, you know,
I wasn't going to say it.
And so, but I couldn't think of any other way to, you know, to break it down. And I hope it's helpful. You know, but for me, whenever I write about or talk about TBRI, the bottom line is it helpful to people? So yeah, I hope it's helpful. There's a book in my bookcase. It's called the title is The Creation of Settings. And there's a book reading by, I think it was by Seymour Saracen, who was a major social psychologist back in the 50s and 60s in the US. And what he wrote the book because he said, we know next to nothing about how to create a setting for a particular purpose, including therapeutic settings. And one of the things that's just amazing about what Karen did that I don't know that we tend to really focus on how she interacted with kids. And obviously that was, you know, amazing, but she created this setting where kids could heal and all the pieces of that setting. And you know, and teachers do something very similar in their classroom. They create a setting for learning, and it's for, you know, a good teacher, it's very natural to create, you know, a setting for learning. And it's no small thing. We kind of take it for granted. And so the context, so that's kind of what was in my mind around the context. And the context, you know, is so important. It can be, And there's the physical context, and that can be warm and inviting, and it can, you know, have the right kinds of lighting, you know, it can have natural lighting as opposed to, you know, and that's something the architects, you know, are, you know, now understand, I think, you know, really well. For example, at Methodist Children's Home, they're tearing down their old dorm style, you know, homes and replacing them with trauma-informed homes, you know, buildings that, you know, reflect the needs of the kids and the staff in better ways. And so the setting, the physical setting is no small thing. And when you talk about climate, that's the kind of the emotional setting, if you will, that you create. And we know from a ton of research that, especially for kids who are, you know, have, you know, challenges in the classroom or in whatever setting it might be, climate matters, you know, a lot to them. So in terms of their outcomes.
You know, I remember back listening to you talk, I was thinking back to when I worked in residential, and I could literally set the climate based on the size of coffee cup that I carried. It was like part of the thing that the kids knew, like, oh God, she's got the big jug. Like, it's going to be a rough day. And it was like probably subtle, but also just how, like, we're laying the groundwork. And I think we have to be so careful in looking at, and it was a thing, it was talked about, like, oh, what size coffee cup does Miss Sarah have today? And it became a playful thing, but literally when you think about it, creating an emotionally safe climate, everything that we do as adults and the importance of literally even like the minutiae of things can be so important. And that was silly and fun and joking and playful, but I guarantee you it could have been the other way, right? Like, yeah, it could have been serious of them being like, oh no, like this is a heavy thing. And just how much influence we have into that emotional climate is so important. So within the flows of experience, we talk about the touch points, timing, and completions. Do you have anything you want to share about those and the importance of those?
Well, the touch points idea, I got from T. Barry Brazelton, and I think it's a really important concept. One way to make that concrete is that notion of know when to fight your battles. And, you know, and so there's certain times when a particular issue, you just need to let it slide. And, you know, other times, you know, so you got to pick your, you know, pick your time to fight your battles or whatever it might be, you know, you got to be strategic about that. One of the things I think that is really subtle, but I think is really important. And again, I, you know, like almost with everything with TBRI, go back to, you know, what my understanding of Karen's practice is, this notion of completions. And it's something I think is really important. And, you know, and I think it's the idea, it comes from a psychologist who first identified the phenomenon was a guy named Zeigarnik, and it's now called the Zeigarnik effect. But what he noticed was that people remembered things better if they didn't get to finish the task, if they were engaged in memory tasks. So this is back when the psychologists were doing a lot of memory research. And one of the things he noticed is just kind of by accident was that if people didn't get to finish learning a list, they actually remembered the words better than if they got to, you know, if they actually had to finish, they got the opportunity to finish it. And so it's like unfinished business. And there's another pair of psychologists who are trauma psychologists who have taken that idea and applied it to trauma and say that one of the things, and I think they're right about this, is that makes trauma so gives it such a hold on us is so very often trauma is unfinished business. You know, we've never had an opportunity to go back and confront our abuser or at least, you know, even maybe even just forgive our abuser. There's just not that opportunity. And I think the same thing happens with our kids. We all know their self-regulation can be fragile. If we have a child who's really engaged in, you know, some activity, maybe they're building something or they're reading something or they're playing a game, and then we just come along and say, okay, we got to stop, and we don't attend to their need to finish, to complete that, then that can be something that'll help kind of make that child, you know, their behavior go off the rails. And thinking back to Karen's practice, she was a master at, and it's hard when you got a group of kids, particularly you got a group of kids who are, you know, that dysregulate so easily. She was a master at allowing the kids, for the most part, you can't do this perfectly well but for the most part, giving them an opportunity, designing activities so they could be completed, and giving the kids an opportunity to complete them and feel like they had finished.
You know, I think it's such a good point too, because as adults, it's so easy to expect kids to operate within our time frame and our context. But as adults, we get to control for a lot of that, we get to control it ourselves. So if I know there's this task I'm going to do, and then I can go into it knowing I may not finish it. And so I already have control over the dysregulation of that and the time and what's going on. But we forget that kids need that too. So they need to at least know going into it, whatever it is, that it's not going to be complete. And I think that's, it's just an example. I think I continue to think about how we have different expectations of kids than we do adults.
And I think
right
what
now
you
the
just,
regulation.
I think what you just said, Sarah, is really important. And that is, you can help kids, we can help kids manage their emotions around completions and not being able to complete by verbalizing it ahead of time, you know, saying, you know, right. And so like, and almost, you know, yeah. So we can, yeah. So it's not just giving, the way that we as adults can help them with this is not just, it's not simply a matter of making sure they have an opportunity to finish, but we can also, you know, talk about, you know, like you said, I mean, you said it better than I am. So
yeah.
Well done.
That's very difficult to believe. Yeah. Well, let's go on to the joints of experience, where we talk about transitions and rituals and the zone of proximal development. And for me, all three of these things are really, really important. And so let's talk about them one by one. Can you talk about the importance of transitions?
Well, I think transitions are interesting. And one of the things that's interesting to me, because one, you know, part of what I see my role as is, and it all, you know, even going back to, you know, the very early days of this work was, you know, what's the, you know, I would ask myself over and over and over again, I'd see Karen do something and I'd say, well, what's the science around that? What do we know about that from a scientific standpoint? And from a scientific standpoint, you know, we know next to nothing about transitions. It's really, it's fascinating to me. But here's my thoughts around it is, I think, you know, we talk about the three pillars. We talk about felt safety, connection, and self-regulation. If you think about a child who has had some, you know, some difficult experiences, and now we're going to change. It may be simply going from one room to another or one activity to another. Their felt safety can be threatened. Their sense of connection can be threatened, and their ability to self-regulate can be threatened. And what we did at camp was we had the thing about Karen would do, we got her on video and I love it, 2 more minutes, you know, so we would help kids develop a sense of control, like they're in control of this transition by giving the advance notice and, you know, and maybe sometimes giving them choices by having a regular routine that we stick with and so on. So for some of the kids who are more cognitively challenged at camp, we actually would create their buddy would go around, would spend a day taking photos of all the different stations of the day and create a bulletin board from their own personalized chart that showed the different activities. And so what those buddies would do is would say, okay, so, you know, Johnny, whatever the child's name is, let's go look at your chart and see what we're going to be doing next and show a photo of it. And so right now we're here and then we're here. And so they, something to help them manage that transition. Then I'll just say this about transitions and changes. If you look at the life stress scale, almost everything on there is a change, is a transition. Mm-hmm. And so transitions are inherently stressful. And if you just think about it from the standpoint of self-regulation, if we're doing something, we're in the middle, you know, like say I'm fixing dinner or I'm reading or I'm watching TV, whatever it is, I'm on automatic pilot. But as soon as I, you know, if I'm going to say I stop doing this and I'm going to start doing this, I've got to up my executive capacity, my executive functioning. Or it's going to, you know, it's going to challenge my executive capacity. And so it's stressful.
And I think that's such a good point, because you know, again, bringing it back to sort of the adult point of view. And as you know, I had to make a few changes in my parenting when I learned TBRI. And one of those things for me was like, I mean, I really grew up with and had the understanding of when the adult says it, you do it, and that the kids should operate under our structure and our timeline and just be ready to go. And when you talk about like it physically creates stress in the child, and when we take those, that idea, it completely changes the framework for why do we slow these things down? Well, because we're trying to eliminate stress, because we do want them to be able to do as much as they possibly can within their capacity in that moment. And so taking that time to manage a transition actually saves us time in the long run, usually, because we avoid dysregulation. But just metabolizing the idea that it's creating stress is so important, that even if it's good, even if it's a good thing that they're going from and to, that's what, doesn't matter. It's still stressful because we're asking them to come out of that comfort place.
Well said.
What about rituals?
Well, rituals are a great way to manage transitions, life transitions. So one of my favorite stories is one that Darren Jones shared from when he was at the behavior care program. And when once he understood TBRI, what he's in, and the importance of transitions, he created a welcoming ritual, a welcoming ceremony for the kids that were coming into. You know, we've talked about context and climate. I mean, think about how different that climate is when, for a child, when you are explicitly welcoming them with a welcome basket and a welcome ritual and so on. I mean, it's mm-hmm. hugely important. You know, and you know, our culture is full of rituals. There's graduation ceremonies. Our son just got married a week ago, a week and a half ago. And, you know, there's, you know, that's an elaborate ceremony for a life transition. In more traditional cultures, we had rites of passage. And it's interesting because a good ritual, ceremony, rite of passage not only helps a young person or an older person manage a transition, but it also helps the formation of identity around that transition. So the when a young person graduates from high school, it's not only about, you know, what's being completed, but what's coming next. Okay. And so, and even in, when we come up with, you know, when we have rituals for daily transitions, they not only signal the completion of what's been going on, but they signal, you know, where we're going next. So it becomes another way to, manage the uncertainty and the anxiety and the fear sometimes that, you know, we can have around transitions. Some of my favorite transitions are ones that teachers, particularly preschool teachers, but, you know, my wife was a retired kindergarten teacher. She did the same thing. They would very often have songs around, an important transition of the day. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, music and songs is a great way to help manage transitions.
Yeah, I love that. And even going back to rituals just for a little bit, I always think of that being the connection factor in transitions and the routine is the ritual is where you almost bring in that connection factor, which we know is where the money is, right? Like when I can build connection in, yeah. I can often build in regulation. And so the ritual in my mind, when I think about trying to get, you know, kids or young adults to move in any direction, whatever it is, I'm trying to train my brain now, like the ritual will bring that connection. So it's like, you know, for somebody who likes being able to check a box, it helps me form my plan around what we're doing next. So like Sarah, build in some connection, build a ritual around this. What can you guys do every single time you do this? And it doesn't have to be anything big or expensive or even take a whole lot of anything to just build connection of a ritual in. And we actually worked with a facility, and you're talking about your wife moving kids with song. they were having a really hard time, this inpatient unit, moving kids from school back to the unit. And the one thing, they did two things. One, they divided the group into two because it was just too big. They were having a lot of AWOL situations and violence during this one transition. And the second thing they did was add a song leader and the song leader got to stand by the adult and led the kids through a song as they moved from, school back. And these were kids all the way from, 5 to 17 years old. And this really, really hard part of the day came now with this ritual where they all felt connected and having fun and playful and all of the things that we want. And then all the incidents began to diminish because they were all connected.
Right? That's a great example, Sarah.
Yeah. So lastly, the zone of proximal development, which we affectionately refer to as the ZOPED. What the heck is that?
Okay. Well, yeah, that's a good question. So first of all, let me sort of a little bit of a historical perspective. So in the very early days of our work, going back to like when Karen was, a student in my child psych class, we looked at a lot of the things that we're talking about through the zone of proximal development and including TBRI and so on. And we talked about scaffolding and all these ideas associated with it. And then for some reason, it kind of dropped out of our training. And I realized a few years back that that this concept, which I think is crucially, or that we thought was crucially important, for whatever reason, is no longer sort of included in the training around TBRI. So I stuck it back in the notebook, and what it means is it's really a pretty basic idea, and that is that we as adults do, whether we're parents or teachers or therapists or coaches or floor staff in a residential facility, whatever it might be, we're constantly scaffolding the emerging skills of our kids. So let's take the example of, let's say we've got a young person who doesn't feel safe. Okay. So much of TBRI is focused on helping scaffolding their capacity for felt safety. So we build connection, we make routines predictable. We have activities that that focus explicitly on like feeling safe. For example, whether it's the attachment ritual or the stranger practice. We do things like we have pets that allow a child to interact with a warm, fuzzy little being, and so on. So there's so many things we do. We manage transitions. We work on self-regulation. One of the things about self-regulation is we may not verbalize it, but if we are having a hard time self-regulating, we don't feel safe, because we feel out of control. That's not a safe place to be. And as adults, we try to provide this balance of structure and nurture, which promotes self. So we're doing all of these things to scaffold a child's ability to self-regulate. And there's kind of two things about that I think that are important. One is that kids, how we scaffold one child may be completely different than how we scaffold another child. And whether it's dependent on age or whether it's dependent on past experience and the particulars of their trauma or their relationship history, when we're good at this, we do it different and we match our scaffolding to the kids. The other thing is that as they develop their skills, then we pull down old scaffolds and we might build new scaffolds. And so, like say scaffolding for a child who's just learning to read might be having reading time at night, and having, reading picture books. But scaffolding for a teen who's trying to study might be being accessible so that, you know, making sure that if they ask for help, we provide the help, or maybe that we provide them with, you know, or maybe that we talk to their teacher about, you know, so our scaffolding might be indirect by interacting with the you know, other people in their lives. So the concept goes back to, and I think an important part of it is that, and this was Vygotsky's original insight, is that when, you know, there's a difference between rats were learning to work their way through a maze or to press a lever to get more food, and humans who are learning in the context of their culture and their people. And so we as humans have all of these cultural artifacts, if you will, like language and books and calendars and paper and pencil. And nowadays we have all these wonderful electronic things. I guess my point is that on the one hand, how we scaffold, we use, like, say, for, you know, I think you gave a great example of it earlier in this conversation when you talked a little bit, Sarah, about how we can remind a child who's struggling with a transition that they maybe have done this before, that they, it's, you know, it's, you know, we still got 2 minutes before we're going to do it. And then, mm-hmm. you know, and then you can verbalize what the transition is going to be. We're going to do this. We're doing this, and now we're going to do this. All of that is scaffolding their felt safety, their ability to self-regulate, and their ability to manage through this thing. But we're using this cultural tool, you know, language to do that. So, yeah. So hopefully that makes some sense.
Dr. Cross, it is always fun to talk to you and learn from you and share time together. So I really appreciate you sharing on the podcast today, and we look forward to hearing from you in the future.
All right. Thank you, Sarah.
The TBRI podcast is produced by the Karen Purvis Institute of Child Development at TCU. To learn more about TBRI and the resources mentioned in this episode, please visit child.tcu.edu/podcast.